We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast. Soylent Green is people. Joining me today is Brooker. How are you doing today?
I am good, thank you, mate. I'm good. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining me. And today we're going to be talking about Blood Relatives, which is season one. But before we get into that, since this is your first time on The Time Is Now, we have the five group initiation questions. Are you ready for these?
Ready? Yeah. Most of my answers are going to be really boring, though. I have to admit.
I don't think it... Okay, I'm not sure you're going to quantify boring, but I'll trust you. Let's do question number one. When did you first discover Millennium?
It would have been not long after, or probably about the time it came out on home video first. So probably would have been, what, 98-ish, the first season? I came across an advert for it in front of X-Files episodes on my X-Files VHS. Literally, that was how I discovered Millennium, was an advert for it on my X-Files tapes.
Wow. And so this is VHS, obviously, that you first watched Millennium. Okay.
Yeah, it... I don't know... I think it aired at, like, really... I think it aired at, like, Channel 4, which, you know, was a bit... Nothing really aired on Channel 4 at a reasonable time in this country. It was, you know, if you went to watch something good, you had to be up at 1 in the morning. You know, I was 16, I had to go to school or work or whatever. I couldn't be doing that. So I discovered this, like I say, through watching X-Files videos and seeing adverts. And to be honest, I mean, the advert sold me, and I went and bought the first season box set on video the day I discovered it was a thing. So, you know, I was hooked.
See, I didn't know they released full seasons on VHS. I've seen a few VHS cassettes. I have like the first few episodes of season one. And then other than that, only thing I ever knew about was when the DVD sets came out. So that's how I didn't see it until much later when the DVD box sets came out.
It might have been DVD. 98, it could have been DVD. It's very possible it was DVD I bought and not video.
I don't know. 98 still seems... That seems like a VHS time. I think your recollection's probably correct. I just... My awareness of the show and when it was released here is very limited.
Mine as well. Like I say, I would have been 16 or 17 when it came out. I was taking far too many substances in various forms to remember anything about that time, clearly.
Right. And then question number two is, what is your favorite episode?
This is an easy one, and I am going to say I'm afraid it's a boring one. But it's the pilot. The pilot for Millennium, okay, so I sat down and watched it, and I was expecting a kind of cool-looking, maybe a little bit dark, police procedural. Outside of from the creator of The X-Files, I had no idea what the show was about, and it blew me away and turned out to be one of the best episodes of horror television I never expected to see.
I don't see why that's a boring one. The pilot deserves deserves its love, especially in the context of when it was released. What a shocker, both in production quality and then also the tone.
This was the thing. Like, I expected it to be I expected it to be good. I see at this point I was an X-Files fan. I expected it to be good. I didn't expect it to be that. It's still one of my favourite episodes of TV in general ever, is the pilot episode to Millennium, because it blew me away with how violent it was, how gory it was, and it was, like I say, just pure horror television in it, which wasn't something I'd really come across up until that point.
Yeah, even in this day and age, going back, it's still a tough watch in some places, so I couldn't imagine watching it back then, because I didn't watch it until probably like 2004, and it had been, you know, TV had changed quite a bit, but when it aired, the response, wow, something else.
Yeah.
Well, then, let's expand that to the next question, which is, what is your favorite season?
Like I say, it's the first. There are a couple of downer episodes in the first, a couple where the quality dips quite dramatically, in my opinion. But for the most part, it's a very solid season. And again, a complete surprise. I had no idea that was what we were getting when I first put the tape or the disc in, whichever it actually happened to be. I was absolutely floored with just how good... I didn't realize TV could do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't think TV could be this scary, this gruesome. Outside of The X-Files, my TV watching was pretty bland up until that point. It was like The X-Files and Friends. You know, there was no in-between for any of this. So to sit down and watch 20-something episodes of Millennium in very quick succession, it really left a mark. I have to admit, you know, it's one of those shows I can't get over. And the first season has a lot to do with that.
I wonder how many people in the end, in just Millennium fandom, it seems that season two gets most of the love. And I wonder if you and I are going to be two of the few people who chose season one as our favorites.
Oh, really? You'd season one's your favorite as well?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
I think it's a lot of this to do with, I think, well, maybe not when you come to it. Like I say, if you came to it in like 2004, because again, for me, it was a surprise. By the time I got to season two, and there's nothing wrong with season two, I think season two is phenomenal television.
Oh, it is. It is.
And
no argument.
And season three, it gets a bit hinky, but season three is very good as well.
Yes.
But there was just something special about that first few episodes where you went, I cannot believe I'm watching this. I cannot believe... And when you get to where we are now, and you go, I can't believe Fox actually allowed this to happen. I can't believe this is TV that was allowed to be made, because people would shit themselves nowadays if something like that hit primetime TV. You know, it's absolutely insane. It's my favorite, one of my favorite seasons of TV, full stop, but for Millennium, absolutely the first season is my favorite.
Great choice, great argument. And question number four is, who is your favorite character?
So this one changed quite recently, actually. So I haven't watched Millennium for a little while. I for no other reason than the fact that I've just been busy with life and other things, and it didn't hit the rotation for quite a while. My favourite character used to be Peter Watts. I think he's a great character. There was always something not quite right about him. You know, his motives were never, he didn't always seem to be a kosher character on screen. There was something always up with him, and I really liked that about him. But, so I've sat down now and watched quite a few episodes recently, and I think it's the first time I've watched Millennium since I had a kid. And I never disliked Frank Black, but holy crap, do I feel just sympathy for everything that dude does now. I sit and watch him on screen, and I'm just terrified for everything he does, especially when, his family get involved. My favourite character has to be Frank. Again, I know that then turns into a relatively boring answer, because everybody should love Frank Black, but I went to watch it after not watching it for a long time, I go to watch it as a parent and go, oh shit, I'm scared for everything that dude does. And I can relate to a lot of what he does. Thankfully, not all. But, I felt a different connection with him watching it, and I fell in love with the character all over again, and more so this time around.
We've got another point of agreement there, and I know it may be boring, but I chose initially Frank Black for my favorite X-Files character, too, just because he's probably my favorite character on television ever. Yeah, I can't argue with anything you're saying, and Hendrickson's performance is really what pushes it over the edge. When you talk about the parenting aspect, some of the stuff that a different actor may not have been able to sell, but like the interrogation scene in Monster in season two is just incredible. It just...
Oh, yeah.
But I don't want to hijack your question, so we got question number five, which is, what is your favorite moment from the show?
I'm going to go back to the pilot, and this happened when I first watched it, and it happens every time I revisit it as well. It's the opening scene in the pilot episode, so you're in the really grimy-ass strip club. And there's that moment where he's talking to the stripper. There's the bloody imagery everywhere. And at the same time, there is, oh God, I forget which one it is. There's a Rob Zombie track playing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I'm almost certain it's More Human Than Human, but I might be wrong. It doesn't matter what it is. It's that thing. So like I said earlier on, you get that horror TV that you didn't expect when you first, or that I didn't expect when I first sat and watched it. You get that really horrific imagery. It feels like you're in the middle of a horror film. And then you add in one of my favorite rock and metal artists doing the music for it at the same time. There was just this moment where everything just came together. And I was just like, holy shit, this is fantastic. Like, if it wasn't such a horrible moment in the scene, you'd want to get up, or I'd want to get up and cheer. It was such a cool combination of everything being brought together.
Got a lot of love for season one and the pilot.
I can't help it.
No,
if someone said to me, give me a random episode of any TV show to sit and watch to convince me to watch something, there would be, let's say, maybe the pilot of The Sopranos, the pilot of Hannibal, and the pilot of Millennium would be my top three picks for anybody to sit and watch. For pretty much the same reasons for each of them as well. It's each one of them is excellent TV that you just don't expect to be that good.
And there's a lot of tonality and theme consistency across those two.
Well, yeah, for Hannibal and Millennium, absolutely. And you get a lot of the same kind of, like the psychology aspect of it with Millennium and with Hannibal. I think a lot of that's why I was drawn to Hannibal when it was on as well. And I was very anti-Hannibal when it came out, to be honest. I had no interest in it. I went in actively wanting to hate it. And then by the end of the pilot, I couldn't help but love it. And I had similar feelings with, obviously, I didn't go into Millennium wanting to hate it. I was really looking forward to it. But I was overwhelmed with how good it was by the time I got to the end of the pilot episode. And that opening scene is a big part of it.
And just the pilot itself is kind of an extrapolation of that opening scene where it's just one big punch to the face out of the gate.
It's a horrifying hour of TV.
And almost much more than the whole rest of the season combined. And the rest of the season combined has some really rough stuff, but
yeah,
it's truth in advertising, in the most part, at least. You know what you're in for when you're done with it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And your mind was made up by the time you got to the end. You weren't sitting there going, maybe I'll give it one or two more episodes. You would know by the end of the pilot episode whether or not this was for you.
Let us transition to talking about Blood Relatives, which is episode 7 of season 1. Just as a brief description of the episode, this happens in Seattle, and it follows James Dickerson, who is visiting a grieving family at a funeral home, and this is during the cold open. The mother of the deceased boy at the funeral there is killed by being dragged into a grave site, and then Frank Black is pulled in, and Peter Watts comes in and helps. They're trying to investigate who did that murder, and then we follow James Dickerson going around to additional funerals and his experience in a rehab home. I'm trying to remember. Do you remember what they call it? I guess halfway house is not what they call it, but a halfway house is good enough. And then, so he has some unknown criminal background, and eventually there's messages left on the victim's bodies, things like stop looking, and James Dickerson's trying to reconnect with his mother, so there's a theme of that going on we'll get into, and he's being kind of aided by the man running the halfway house in escaping. He escapes from the cops, hides out in a junk factory, is eventually captured. He's interrogated and eventually gives up and admits to the crime. Frank Black figures out that it's actually not him who did it, but in fact the man running the halfway house. And that is generally a rough summary. I don't want to go into too much detail here, so we can talk about it together, but that's a brief description. What rating would you give Blood Relatives?
I don't think I would rate this very high, I'll be honest. I don't know, at a push, maybe 5 or 6 out of 10.
That's good. I'd give it a 6. Yeah, I think it's got some issues in the script department and the plot department, but I think it's got some nice character beats, and it pushes up a little higher for me because of that.
Yeah, it's got a couple of interesting character beats. It's nice that we get Catherine in as more as just the wife in this episode.
Yes.
I like that. But here's the thing. I sat and watched this episode again last night, in preparation for recording, I can't remember most of what happened. It's genuine. I didn't think I would actually find an episode of Millennium that I could call forgettable. I've forgotten most of the episode, and I watched it 24 hours ago. Nothing in the episode really stuck with me. And I think the problem with that is it's on either side of it are much better episodes. And I think that's when you're watching, let's call it binge watching, when you're binge watching the show, that's a bit of an issue when you've got much better episodes going around it. It's not a poor episode. I couldn't pick this one out of a lineup if you asked me to. I think that's an issue. I think it's an issue with script. I think it's an issue with, I don't think it's production. I think the quality of the episode, production-wise, is as good as the rest of the season. I just, there's something just, I don't know, it falls a bit flat for me.
Sure thing. Yeah, that's a fair thought. It was written by Chip Johannesson, who later went on to produce season 3, and directed by Jim Charleston, and I don't know if he directed any others. I can't remember. What do you think the IMDb rating is for this, if you haven't already checked?
I haven't checked, and I would say it's probably about 7. I'd like to think that most people watching it would kind maybe not agree with me completely, because maybe I'm being a bit too negative, but the problem with an old show on IMDb is you get a lot of fans clicking the 10.
Yeah.
Just because so I'd think about a 7, I'd guess.
That's pretty good, yeah. It's actually a 7.5, and that's just dead center for the season. So it's tied with Dead Letters and The Wild and the Innocent, and it's above Well-Worn Lock, Wide Open, Kingdom Come, Walkabout, Broken World, Maranatha, which are at 7.4. So there's this big cluster of episodes. Yeah. Like, the majority of the season is right between 7.4 and 7.5, and only one episode is Lowing Like a Hunting Flame, which is at 7.2. Yeah. So it's about where you're thinking with the 7. I think people are agreeing with us there.
It's a shame to see Kingdom Come be a bit low, because I quite enjoyed Kingdom Come, I have to admit. I thought that was quite a good episode.
Are you going to be talking about that on the time?
I'm not, no. I just... Okay.
It'd be interesting to see your thoughts, because that's one of the episodes that never really grabbed me very much.
Okay.
And I'd love to hear a defense of it. I would like to like it more, if that makes sense. And that's one thing about these podcasts, is for people to give me a different perspective and to see things from a different lens. Hopefully, at least you can share some good listener feedback when that podcast comes up.
Oh, absolutely, I will. Yeah, it's a fun episode. I think I preferred it to this one, not by much, but I did prefer it to this one. And the Well-Worn Lock, actually, I quite like as well. Like, yeah. I say, this one, I think, is bookended by a couple of much better episodes. Maybe not story-wise, like, you know, the Inquisition kind of stuff for Kingdom Come is a bit much, but I did enjoy it nonetheless. But yeah, this episode, it's okay. Okay, so it is a horrible way to describe an episode, because you wouldn't want anyone to describe anything you wrote as only okay. But in a season that is so good, even your duff episodes are decent, and I kind of hope that comes across when I say I didn't enjoy it that much, but I still love it in context of the season.
No, it makes perfect sense, and I completely agree. As a whole, the episode is relatively forgettable, but I think it has some good ideas and some good performances. Like I said earlier, some character beats. And so we can dig through it here a little bit and see what there is in there that works and doesn't work. Starting off the cold open, we have Jeffrey Allen Court, who was the football player from Washington State University, who is killed. And we have James Dickerson showing up at the funeral pretending to be a friend. We got a fun, not really a cameo, but a performance by Nicole Parker, who played the stoner in quite a few of the Darren Morgan episodes in The X-Files. And yeah. I thought she did a pretty good job. Some of the directing is a little intense there in the opening, but I think she does a good job. And overall, that setting of the scene works pretty good. And then it transitions to, I think, the mother going out to the gravesite and then being pulled in and killed. So what do you think about both those elements, the cold opening and the initial, like, dramatic murder? What are your feelings?
I like the dramatic murder. I think, actually, it worked very well. And it felt like you were watching the beginning of a Millennium episode. You kind of knew it was coming, obviously, but I thought it worked very well in the context of the episode, and it was a decent, it wasn't a scare, but it was a decent little jump. I quite liked it. The cold open was okay, I think, as a whole. Again, not my favourite. is it Sean Six? I think the guy that plays James Dickerson. I think he plays, he done Creepy very well. And he straight away you get a creepy feeling about him. Obviously you're going to know he's the dodgy one in this episode, but you feel like there's something wrong. You feel like he's going to do something much, much darker than this episode is going to let on early on. And that I enjoyed. That I thought was done very well.
I had a slightly different take on Sean Six in that this is one of the excellent parts about the episode is the casting of him. I think he's got a perfect face in that he's creepy, but he's also sympathetic. It's hard to tell sometimes when you're looking at him, and I'm trying to balance both of those emotions. And
yeah.
I think they casted it perfectly well to where at the end, you find out that he is not the killer, and it still works. And he's not so creepy that it becomes cartoonish. Like perhaps maybe the character in Loin Like a Hunting Flame where they really amp it up into the casting. Here, yeah. He could be both, and there's a level of ambiguity in it, even though obviously we're following the character. He's supposed to be the red herring, and we're supposed to be following it.
Yeah.
I think it was a real boon by whoever did the casting for that. I think it's an okay thing at the beginning for the set piece being pulled into the grave, but even watching it again, I still don't understand how it works logically, and that's fine. Not everything has to make a lot of sense, but really, I struggled. It took me out of the episode a little bit, knowing who the killer is, and why would they be there? Why would they be in the grave? Why would the mother go to visit the grave in the middle of the night? Maybe she would, but what is happening? And it kind of took me out of it, but yeah, you know, it works okay visually.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you have to suspend a lot of disbelief for this opener, and for a big portion of this episode, actually, not just the opening bit. Like you say, nothing ever has to be logical. It's late 90s TV. You have to be quite forgiving of late 90s TV, I've found. But I do get what you mean. But at the same time, I like that it is completely hokey when you do discover who the killer is, and you go, well, why was he there? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense at all. But I quite like the way, if you could sit and watch it again, and if you could forget that you knew who the bad guy actually was, I think it plays out much better. And as a mystery, it plays very well for that opener.
Sure. It's totally fair. And speaking of something that you mentioned earlier, and I totally agree with, is another benefit of this episode is we get some work for Catherine to do. And she's actually the gateway for us into the episode. She's called in by the Seattle police through victim services. And we then have a meeting with her and Bob Bletcher to talk about the issues with the father and the daughter wanting to see the mother, and Bletch saying it's not a good idea. Conversation between the two of them. How'd you think about this scene?
I quite like it. It was, like I said earlier, it was nice to have Catherine come in and be more than just the wife. I think it was something that had to happen because she was obviously smarter than just the wife character, so it was nice to have her given a bit more and shown a bit more to do. And I think I had the conversation played out. I enjoyed it a lot. I liked watching her be her. But you see the same sympathetic character that she is when she's at home with Frank and with Littlen, and I think it's great that that her job in, obviously her job in the show, allows her to be like that with everybody, not just with, you know, when she's at home. And it made the conversation, I think it played out very well. I liked it.
So one of my favorite parts about the episode is the interaction between the two. And I am somebody who's a big fan of Catherine Black and think it's kind of often undersold, the role and the competence of the character and the relationship her and Frank actually have in the text. And the fact that this is followed by Well-Worn Lock, where she gets to be center stage even more, is great to have these two in a row. And that Bletcher, in this episode, he's made to be a little bit of a bad guy. But not so much. And then again, in a little bit in the Well-Worn Lock, a little bit more so, where he's kind of on the side of the corrupt. Not really on the side, but he's being pushed by the corrupt politicians and things. And so to see that going here where he's still sympathetic, but he's not cartoonish. This is another thing I like about Millennium is these three leads in particular, the way they interact. Giebelhaus is a fun character and he gets better as time goes on. But he's a little cartoonish, and Bletch and Bill Smitrovich added a lot in these early episodes. And I think this shows the strength.
Yeah. Absolutely. Unlike, let's say, the X-Files, where there's a tongue-in-cheekness through the whole thing, mostly. Obviously, you get your occasional very serious episodes, but for the most part with the X-Files, there is an underlying tongue-in-cheekness about the show. And it's, you know, take it all with a pinch of salt, bit of fun. Obviously, there, you know, people take it very, very seriously, and that's great, I do as well, but you can sit and watch X-Files and it'd be fun. But there are moments in Millennium where you go, I'm not sure I'm supposed to be enjoying this.
Exactly.
Because everybody is taking this very, very seriously, and this is a very, very dark show. There's no ambiguity with Millennium where there is in the X-Files. It's meant to be dark, it's meant to be horrifying, and you need characters, you need leads that can pull that off, but that you can still be sympathetic with. And Bletch and Frank especially, I think, do that perfectly. Like you say, especially in the early episodes.
So I found the name. It's actually a remand center, which is like the halfway house was the term used for it. So that's just, who knew? And Frank Black is called in, and they find out that the pin is missing from the body. And then Ray Bell, using the fake name and trying to make the connection. Transitioning to that, we get a bit later where Jordan and Catherine are at home reading a book called Gator Goes Home. And this is one thing I really love about Millennium, is that each episode's talking about something that has a socio-political importance. And here we talk about neglect and family and perhaps toxic masculinity, but also toxic femininity in this episode here. It's interesting. 45 minutes, you got to sometimes push that envelope. But like the book, if nobody notices, it's fine. But Gator Goes Home. Watching it this time, I was like, that's a little bit on the nose. But that's okay, because immediately right after that, there's the snore that Jordan does, and then the smile Catherine does right after that. And I know it's still television, I know it's still sort of fantasy, but that acting, similar to the scene where they first arrive at the house in the pilot with Jordan and Frank Black, and that strangely naturalistic, or at least very different from television at the time, and I think even television now, the interactions between parents and kids is something I really appreciate about the show in this episode. That scene there is one of the highlights, even though philosophically it's a little over the top. I think the quiet moments we get of light in this very dark show are excellent.
Yes, they are. They're moments to enjoy, especially like you say, with the two of them and Jordan. It's nice to watch just the family be the family. And especially a little bit later on when you start to kind of sit yourself in Frank's shoes and you sit and go, like, he's, and Catherine, I've seen this episode and the next one. These guys are seeing some really horrible, horrible shit, but they still have to go home. They still have to be mum and dad and, you know, parents and husbands and things. And they have to still be family members. And it's nice when you get those moments and they've switched off. They've been able to have their family moment, and you can just sit and you can relax with them as well. Just take a breath for a couple of minutes before more horrible shit happens.
Definitely. And that's one of the things I love. I know we're not talking about Warren Locke and the way Frank just kind of hangs back and is supportive, but it's not in a cartoonish sense where they'd swell the music in a show nowadays and I'm here for you and I'll support you. He's just like, hey, you tired? Yeah. You need breakfast? And it feels so much it feels so much warmer. And I don't want to use the word authentic as a tricky thing, but it feels, I think, emotionally authentic. It does for me.
Authentic works. Authentic's a good, it might be a bit, I know what you mean when you say it feels like the wrong word to use, but it does feel, authentic, I think, is the right word. Because realistic doesn't sound like the right word either, but also that's what it is. It's not a TV family, it's just a family. You know, it's not, you know, a written for TV four people live in a house sitcom. This is just what people do when they're not at work. And I quite like that. It's almost like you're a fly on the wall for an actual family. You're not watching a scripted show for a little while.
That was a fun diversion. I appreciate you bearing with that, but back to blood relatives.
No, it's fine.
So James Dickerson, before he goes to the next funeral, he goes back to the remand house, and there's Connor, who's running the house, gets angry at him for breaking curfew and says, I won't be able to cover for you. So there's this implication that this has been going on a long time. And this kind of plays into Frank Black's suspicion that he just changed. This is something he's been doing, but now the violence has changed. Then James Dickerson, again played by Sean Six, goes to a different funeral and is up fiddling in some bedroom. And then a woman walks in, Tina, and he pretends again to be a friend, a childhood friend of the person who was killed. And then they go to a lake, and he does that weird, creepy hug thing, and it seems to cross the line into some sort of sexual thing, and she gets really uncomfortable. So he goes for a walk, and she gets killed. And then eventually she has the words, "Stop looking," cut into her stomach. What are your thoughts about how all this plays out?
There's something quite horrifying about this scene. Even if you haven't seen the episode before, it's kind of obvious what's going to happen. There would be a couple of ways that usually TV would go with this. So you'd get kind of, she'd be drowned. TV nowadays, you'd get quite a graphic drowning sequence and it would be tough to watch. Or, you know, back mid-late 90s, you'd, next scene, she would just be found in the lake. But here you get something kind of in the middle, and there's something quite horrifying about it, though, where she turns around, she gets hit, and there's no, to say there's no on-screen violence sounds wrong, but there's no graphic on-screen violence. But what you do get is that one moment of her, she's under the water, and just that line of blood coming out of her mouth, kind of misting into the water, and you sit and watch, you go, that's actually quite horrible. I don't know what it was about it. It just seemed like a really horrifying moment of television. It just, I was like, oh, that's quite cold. It's not like a glorified, like I say, you get a really graphic scene nowadays where they struggled and someone was drowned horribly. It's cold. It's just, I don't know. It's a horrible moment. But it's not glorified like it would be in television now. It's not, it's not over-stylized. There's no, massive orchestral piece of music over it as it happens. It's just one hit, and now she's in the water, just dead. And you kind of get that, oh, that was over quick. That was quite horrible.
The setting for it, I think, works well. It's a beautiful, striking lake, but they don't overplay it. It's not like, look at this beautiful place and this horrible thing is going to happen. But it is so easily could have been a really nice moment between the characters. It could have. And then he pushes it too far. And I think that's an interesting thing we can talk about is if it's just him being weird about the family thing. And I think it's actually crossing over a little bit from the family into something more sexual, which makes it uncomfortable, and you feel really bad for Tina, and she's not in it a lot, but I think the time they get to react and the fact that she's drug into it, they don't give you a lot of time to care for the character, but you get enough that this was a murder that you're like, oh my god, it's not just the way it's portrayed, which you're totally right about that, it is a shocking thing, but it's also just the situation she's in emotionally and being brought there, that we in the millennium, you don't always get this chance to see the character and emotionally connect at all before they get dispatched. And I think this is a really effective scene. And compared to the first kill, the first with the graves, I think this one makes a little bit more sense. I mean, you don't know all the details. It's a little weird, but I think it's more plausible. And I think the carving and the rest as like a set piece, this works really well.
Yeah.
When I think of the episode, I think of that and the letters carved in the stomach and how horrifying it is. Poor gal and all the rest. And after they find her with the carving, this is when Terry Watts gets called in, and then he finds the fingerprints on the hair clip that connect it to James Dickerson. And this is when Connor helps him escape. And he goes to the scary junkyard. And eventually they get caught. They catch him, send the dogs. I found that scene to be also very pathetic. And I think this is one thing the episode does pretty well. It goes back to casting him as both creepy and sympathetic. It's about at this time you think he may or may not be guilty, but it's likely that he is. But even the way he's attacked by the dogs and the way that's filmed in the junkyard, well, I don't know, when I watch it, I still feel pretty sympathetic. It's a pretty sad thing to watch. And then in context, when you know what's really happening, it's a really depressing episode.
Yeah. Yes, it is. You're right. Yeah, the thing with the dogs, it did throw me a little bit. I thought the same as you. It didn't seem to fit right for a guy that you were pretty sure was guilty. But like you say, by this point, you have kind of thought, is he? Isn't he?
Yep.
There's a seed of doubt at this point, and I that makes it a little bit kind of. That's what makes this episode interesting, is the red herring with him, because I admit I didn't see that as a. I wouldn't have seen that coming when I first saw it, and on a revisit I forgot that was what was happening. So I was very anti him to start with. I was not realizing that wasn't wasn't him that was going to be the killer by the time I got to the end. But the whole scene with him in the junkyard, that was I quite liked that scene actually. It was him hiding out in a car in a junkyard that was something I didn't see coming. Everything about him hiding out, him just trying to sneak past the dogs, and Connor coming and spending time with him in the car. It's a very uncomfortable few scenes. And this is where, with that and the body carving, now I feel like I'm watching a Millennium episode. Now I'm back in. Do you know what I mean?
Unfortunately, we transition to what I think is the weakness of the episode, and that's when he's in interrogation. And Catherine goes to meet Mrs. Duchance, who is his biological mother. And two problems here for me, and I would like to see what you think, is I think the character is not written sympathetically at all. And I think the acting done by, I'm not sure who it is who does the acting. And I'm, again, not trying to knock. I mean, they're probably fine. They're better than I could ever do. But I don't think they work. They're not in Millennium. They're in Law and Order, or they're in, I don't know what, 90210.
They're a CSI character as well.
Yeah, there's no sympathy at all to that character. You cannot see their point of view at all, and that is exactly what you would need. And it shouldn't be that hard. This is the idea of she had the kid when she was a teen. She moved on, but instead she's just over the top cold. Yeah. Much, 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 much too cold. And that is a real weakness. Counterpoint to that, I think in this entire scene, Sean Six does a really good job.
He does. He is fantastic. I think he does an excellent job. Her kind of, how would you describe, recoiling from it?
Yes. Yeah.
When
yeah.
That, I think that's great. She is, like you say, very, very cold, but I think he sells it very, very well. But I agree completely. I don't enjoy her character on the screen. I don't think she does a very good job of portraying a character that you should be able to feel sympathy for. If written properly and if portrayed well, you should be able to sit there and go, I would understand why you did that. I don't agree with you, but I understand why you did that. And you don't. You Yes. care about as much about her reasoning as she does for him. And I couldn't care less about her. And I think that is a failing in the episode.
It's a big failing. I think in the way that her, current life is, it's too contrasting with his life. And it would have been really easy, like you said, to at least understand and sympathize with what she's doing. Because then we get to the final scene where she's going to be attacked. That would have added a little bit more stakes. It would not be hard to make the audience care for her. And it's not like you wanted her to get attacked. Of course not. But, you could have raised the drama a little bit more and connected her emotionally to the episode. But instead, that third act is almost part of a different episode.
You don't need a soap opera-esque, oh, my son. You don't need that. But you need it to be portrayed and written better. You need a reason to feel sympathetic for this woman, and like you say, when her final offering, I don't care, and I should, like you say, I don't want her to be killed, but when it happens, she's like, all right, I don't care, just get over with, be done with it, because it's a character I have no connection with, no sympathy with, I couldn't care less about her, and that's. That seems like the wrong position for me to have on yep. the long lost mother of our what turns out to be victim.
Yes, and that's a very unfortunate thing, because if they would have fixed that, I think the episode would be an 8, in my opinion. Yes. I think this is the major failing, is that they don't give her any humanity And that's just not fair. I mean, because the situation they're talking about, that is such an intense, I think it's a more common situation than not in a lot of ways. And to not humanize and not deal with it is a major failing of the episode. The second thing is, this is one of the major things I wanted to bring up with you, and I'm going to sound like a broken record on this Millennium podcast, but one of the things, whenever I'm on here, one of the things I like about season one especially is I find most of the episodes kind of take a different aspect of masculinity, especially in the context of the 90s, but it's applicable now. And a lot of it's just humanity. It doesn't have to be specifically, but because we're following Frank Black and because most serial killers are men and we're dealing with pathologizing and trying to understand how trauma begets trauma, all of this stuff, which I think is really important, Millennium, I think, does a really good job. This one's an interesting one in that we have somebody who was abandoned and neglected, and you got those great quotes from Bletch about the kittens, I think it is, and that if it's feral or not by some of the certain time, you'll know. And that's excellent. That's excellent writing. And then here, what you have is Connor. And Connor is, in a way, a little cartoonish, but not nearly as I think most other shows would do. And trying to play it up in this sort of, and I hate to coin this new word and get in trouble, but because I'm in this context, of toxic femininity, in the sense of this overly protective, overly controlling abuse through the guise of caring. And again, I'm not a gender scholar, so I apologize for this. But in the context, there are certain things that are coded, like when he walks in with his bathrobe and the way he crosses it. He goes in and interrupts Connor and like scolds him. That's something that it's very clearly he's doing that. Something like a mother would do in a 90s or an 80s film. They're trying to code this. And you have Connor being in control of James. He's complete neglect from his biological mother, but compassionate, abusive, control from his pseudo-mother, Connor. They just would have fixed his biological mother angle. This is very fun. This is not fun, but this is an interesting aspect for the show to play with. And the fact that people often call this show a serial killer of the week show, I couldn't disagree more. I think this is a human trauma or psychology problem episode of the week, and they put a serial killer to tie it. And the fact that they could do this with this episode and then at the end wrap it up with something so bleak and sad. Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff in this episode, and that's some of the things I took away. I don't know what your thoughts are.
I think I agree with most of it. I think I'm not sure that I would call Connor his surrogate mother. I don't think I would disagree completely. I think what I would say is he's just a surrogate parental figure would probably be the way I'd put. I don't think it's necessarily just his mum or just his dad or, but you know, both or neither. It's just an a figure of authority for him that he kind of responds to as a parental figure. I don't think maybe Connor is doing it on purpose. I think he is putting Connor in his mind. Connor is his is a parental figure for him to follow. Which is why he's so easily manipulated by, I can't cover for you anymore, you better run, from the police who have turned up at the door for nothing. Because as far as he's concerned, he doesn't think he's done anything wrong. But he's been manipulated into legging it out the back door because this person who has this kind of power over him has convinced him that he's done something wrong.
Well, he did break curfew. Yes. And that's enough for, in the fear. And to be clear, I think it's fair that it is just a parental figure, I think, in the text. I think the actor is doing things to code it more feminine.
Okay,
the way he's going. And just even the way of, like, feeding him, his body language, a lot of those aspects. But I think your reading is totally legitimate. I'm trying to think if they could have done more with their biological mother, there could have been something interesting on that.
Yeah. I think if they'd have played it up with him a little bit more, the feeding is very interesting because, like you said, I'm going to come off almost as bad as you saying the words toxic femininity. Blokes don't do that. Men don't feed their kids.
Well,
of course they fucking do. But in the 90s, of course
on
not.
Television, when you're dealing with serial killers, it's coded. So
you're spot on. With that, and I think it would be more believable, maybe not the right word. You could believable is the right word. You could believe it more if, and we'll come back to it again, if they done something a bit better with the biological mum. If they fleshed that out a little bit more, if they made her sympathetic, if they made her believable, if they made us care for her, I think it would be more obvious that Connor was doing that as a, in a female kind of direction. But because they don't with the biological mother, because they basically, I think they kind of expect you to go, oh, it's a biological mother, way, and not put any effort into writing for her and not put any effort into making you believe or making her sympathetic to you, because that should be your go-to emotion anyway. Clearly it's not. But because there is that thought process in it where they've gone, well, it's the biological mum. Everyone's going to be happy that he's found his biological mother. Because they haven't put any effort into that, it does kind of ricochet backwards into the episode and changes the dynamic with him and Connor.
Yes. And they're also doing it just to rub in our faces of how pathetic James is and how bad a situation is. And also yeah. that even though he's pathetic and he's bad, he's still creepy, and the fact that he's stalking his mother, sending all these letters, and the way he interacts, he can't even relate to her in an authentic way. Yeah, that's, and I'm assuming that was intended by James to do like the hug, oh, you came for me, is being so forced and dramatized. But
yeah,
you know, I'm with you there.
There's that very the hug with his mum. Obviously, that should set him off, because obviously there's a lot of commonality between that and the hug with the woman at the lake earlier on as well. The female having that kind of reaction to him in far too many facets of his life, I think is an interesting thing that is on screen for you to see, but it's not explored enough in the episode, I don't think.
Amen. No, I like it. Totally. And so that basically wraps up that she's gets attacked. Frank finally realizes that it isn't James who did it, but it's Connor. Goes in to save her, and we have a pretty dramatic, intense fight scene. I think the fight scene at the end works pretty well. What are your thoughts? You're more into that kind of stuff. You're a better equipped to criticize it than I think I am. You're a better judge of a good final confrontation.
Of a good fight scene. I quite like it because it feels like a fight between two people that aren't meant to fight. You know, this guy's, Connor's been beating up and killing unsuspecting defenseless women for the last 45 minutes. He's not used to anybody fighting back. And Frank, he's a psychologist. This fighting isn't what he does. So actually what they've done, they've made that fight look like a pair of people that don't fight very well or don't fight very often and certainly don't fight properly, and made it quite a tense little standoff. I quite liked it, actually. It was a good little moment.
It looks painful. Yeah.
Yes.
This goes back to one of the reasons I love this show and I love Frank Black. Is one of the first episodes I did for this podcast was The Judge. And how many television shows, even now, ends with a confrontation with the main character walking into a house? The situation's already done, and just talking to somebody calmly. And not even like a big confrontation like, you got to stop what you're doing, but just talking to somebody. And then the episode ends. And here we have Frank, who just goes in, gets in a tussle. Yeah, it's a pretty action thing, but like you summed up, he is not an action hero, and it just feels painful.
Yeah.
It didn't get me like thrown up like a Die Hard, I want to, you know, go out there and punch a tree, but more of like, oh, I'm going to need to take, you know, if I was Frank, I'm going to need to take a couple weeks off of work to recover.
Yeah, I'm going to need to ice my hands, and I'm going to need to, yeah, I'm going to need a nice, long, warm bath.
After that cold bath, who knows what the temperature was of that drowning. Okay, so do you have any final thoughts before we do a brief listener feedback?
I don't. You know what? It's one of those times, and I do this a lot, and this happens a lot with the X-Cast and Fringe recently as well. You kind of go in and go, I didn't enjoy that episode as much as I thought I did. And then actually you talk to somebody about it. And actually, once you get to talk it out a bit, you think you've enjoyed it a bit more. I think I stick with my 6 out of 10 rating, but I don't think it's maybe as bad as I came into thinking, you know, an hour ago when we started recording.
Well, yeah, you did say 5 or 6 out of 10, yeah, so now it's moved up to 6. This is great.
6 out of 10. Yeah. I'll leave it there. I think it's deserving of that. Like I said, though, it's not a bad episode of TV. It's just, it's not the best episode of Millennium. And I say this about a lot of TV as well. The Sopranos is a go-to of mine. Almost every episode of The Sopranos to me is a 10 out of 10 episode. The Sopranos is a 10 out of 10 show. A bad episode of The Sopranos is still better than 99.9% of television I watch. So to say it's not the best Millennium episode is in no way to say it's a bad episode of TV. It's just not the greatest episode of Millennium I've seen.
Amen. They can't all be perfect.
No, they can't.
Listener feedback, we got a message. We had kind of this at the last minute, but Michael Little kindly wrote in. Thanks so much, Michael. And he wrote, I think, pretty much in agreement with us. One of the better episodes of the first half of season one. A great teaser, and the twist with the killer is great. I like seeing Catherine more involved in the story.
Yeah, man. To see Catherine to get a front and center role in a couple of episodes is great.
Yes.
And again, late, you know, mid to late 90s TV, not something that happened very often. So it was nice that you can throw all the horrible labels you like at Chris Carter and the people that write for him. But, you know, the wife character got a front and center part in a couple of episodes. And that still doesn't happen that often nowadays.
Yeah, and the wife is probably more competent, if not as equal competent, to the main protagonist. And that they're clearly partners. And
yes, it's absolutely.
The fact that you can have this healthy, non-competitive, because even in the 90s they'd do that, it was always very oppositional, like, yeah. Oh, the woman is powerful in opposition to the man, as opposed to this woman can be more powerful in a constructive way, in a positive way, and not make it, because that's so unhealthy when they make it out to be this threat, or it's like this violence thing that just perpetuates, it makes things worse. You're not helping feminism by portraying powerful women as negative.
No.
I mean, you want to portray all kinds of people in all kinds of ways, but the fact that they would leverage that against Carter is, again, it's not perfect, but let's give him some credit. I mean, we got Scully for crying out loud.
Yeah.
And Catherine Black, and also just Frank Black, somebody who, I mean, you look at, why can't you cheer him on for giving us a realistic, positive, masculine portrayal that is completely absent in television then and now?
Absolutely. A bloke doing his job and trying to be a dad and a husband. And you know what, mate? I can relate to that more than I can relate to most TV characters nowadays. Obviously, I'm lucky enough. I don't have to go to work and deal with sexual assault and murder.
Yes.
And people carving notes into other people's bodies. And I'm thankful for that. But as a character... Yeah, me too. But as a character, I can relate to Frank Black more than I can relate to most TV characters, especially TV blokes nowadays, and definitely TV blokes in modern TV, because, my God, most of them are douchebags. I love Frank Black, and I think he's a perfectly written character.
And in the 90s, the fact that you have this guy who is so prioritized towards his family, but it's not like, look at me, I'm super dad, or look at me, I'm super husband. He's this wounded guy who's there, and he's just trying to be nice, trying to be supportive, trying to do what he can. And how refreshing is that, just to have somebody trying to be good, and it's not constantly shoved in our faces and telegraphed, like, wow, a man being a dad. A woman who's a strong, competent, well, come on, you know.
Yeah, well, his mom who's also got a job. Whoa.
This is crazy. And the kid's still functioning. Wow. Who would know? Is that possible?
Well,
three cheers for Millennium. So
absolutely.
Well, I gotta say, this has been a great time talking with you. Thanks so much for taking the time, and I hope we can do another one of these in the near future.
Oh, absolutely, dude. This has been awesome. I love talking Millennium and X-Files and everything I talk about. I love talking with people that I wouldn't usually talk to about it.
Yeah,
this is great. It's awesome to get a point of view from someone that's a fan, but a different fan.
Amen.
You know what I mean?
Oh, I do. It's been a blast. Thanks so much, Bricker, and thanks to all the listeners for listening, and remember, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook, if you type in The Time Is Now, plus we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show The X-Cast and X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.